This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 153, Blood Relations. So I actually had some cultural history planned for this episode, but I'm shifting things around just a bit for narrative purposes. Instead, if you couldn't guess from the title, we're going to talk about the royal family of Antiochus II Theos, and everything that entails on this show. Last time, I covered some of the foreign relations and regional politics playing out in Antiochus's reign, during and after the Second Syrian War. All of the little kingdoms of northern Anatolia were angling for power in competition with one another, and through a marriage pact, Antiochus singled out Cappadocia. Over in Babylon, there was some sort of uprising or long-term unrest in the first half of Antiochus's reign, but we only know about it from some very fragmentary astronomical records. There was pillaging outside the walls and rioting, if not outright combat within. Then, all the way in the northeast, the satraps of Parthia and Bactria, Andragoras and Diodotus, became increasingly self-sufficient and autonomous under Antiochus's rule, as they were left to fend off the invading Parni Saka. While mostly successful, Parthia in particular suffered a heavy loss when the Parni warlord Arsaces conquered Ostoene, renamed it Arshak in his own honor, and declared himself an independent king in Hellenistic fashion. We are going to leave Arsaces on a cliffhanger for now, and get back to the Seleucid royal court. As usual with these things, we start with Antiochus the god's mother, Stratonike. I mentioned that she died shortly before the end of the Second Syrian War in that episode, and told the little story about the elderly queen getting involved with a scandalous painting depicting herself, nude, with a local fisherman. That is actually pretty reflective of the few stories of Stratonike as queen mother that have survived. By all accounts, she was very popular with the people in Sardis and Ephesus, a patron of the arts, and some combination of good-humored and vain that is hard to pin down. The later Roman poet Lucian wrote that poets of the time were sure to praise the Queen Mother's good looks and luscious hair, despite her hair falling out from disease. Either way, she died in early autumn of 254 BCE after a long period of terminal illness, survived by all but one of her children. The only known child to die before Stratonike was, of course, Crown Prince Seleucus, for his attempted rebellion against Antiochus Soter, which paved the way for Antiochus Theos to wear the crown in the first place. We're now 3 generations into the Seleucids, and they've fully evolved into a royal family at this point, with all of the reasonably well-documented cousins and in-laws that we got used to with the Achaemenids. Unlike the Persian dynasty before them, who were usually marrying within their own nobility, the Seleucids and other Diadochoi dynasties were all intermarrying as well, resulting in an even wider spread and better documentation for more family members. So we begin with Antiochus II's older sister slash step-grandmother, Phila. This is really just a check-in and farewell to the only daughter of Stratonike and Seleucus Nicator before Stratonike remarried Antiochus Soter. Phila was the wife of Antigonus Gonatas and queen of Macedon. By all indication, they had a happy enough marriage, and Phila showed little interest in politics, preferring religious and artistic patronage instead. Gonatas and Phila had 2 sons, one of which died early in their reign, and the other, Demetrius, was the clear heir to his father's throne, and likely ruled as co-king alongside the elderly Gonatas. Even before coming to power on his own, this Demetrius had a growing reputation for military success after defending Macedon from an Epirote invasion around 260 BC. Moving on to Antiochus Theos's full siblings, we start with an easy example of how blurry generational lines can get with Stratonike of Macedon. If you Google this Stratonike and her mother, the names and titles get very odd. To clear things up, Stratonike of Syria is the mother, a Macedonian princess who moved to Syria to marry Seleucus and then married Antiochus. Stratonike of Macedon is the daughter, a princess from Syria who moved to Macedon in order to marry her nephew, Demetrius. Unlike her sister and father-in-law, Stratonike and Demetrius had a rocky marriage on the whole. She found the Antigonid prince boorish, but politics and marriage being what they were at the time, they did have one child during Antiochus II's reign, a daughter named Apama. Of course, as a princess herself, Apama will rejoin the story in her own marriage alliance down the line, but for now, Stratonike and Demetrius II primarily served to reinforce the Seleucid-Antigonid alliance against Egypt for another generation. Antiochus II also had another sister, who was, of course, another Apama. And at this point, she was probably the second most powerful of all her siblings. This Apama is the one who was sent west just before the First Syrian War to marry Magus of Cyrenaica, the Ptolemaic rebel who split off his own little kingdom in Libya. Well, around 250, King Magus did 2 things. He arranged to reconcile with his brother Ptolemy Philadelphus through a marriage pact. Philadelphus's grandson and heir apparent after the Second Syrian War would marry Magus and Apama's daughter Berenike, when the children both came of age. Of course, this Ptolemaic prince was named Ptolemy. They do have standards to maintain. Then, shortly after the betrothal, Magus died. Since Berenike was an only child, the betrothal plan would have rejoined Libya and Egypt in marital union rather than conquest. Instead, the Seleucid queen of Cyrenaica got worried that Philadelphus would just invade and take them by force now that Magus was dead. So she summoned Demetrius the Fair, the younger brother of King Antigonus in Macedon, and they had a wedding. Not for herself, but for her daughter, a teenager at the time. This made Demetrius the new king, and tied Cyrenaica into the wider Antigonid-Seleucid protectorate more firmly. The wedding ceremony was pure political theater. Apama and Demetrius were the actual lovers in this situation, but in the next couple of years, as Berenike reached her late teens and neared adulthood, she realized she hated that arrangement. She was the legitimate heir to the kingdom, but had no power. She was supposed to marry a powerful king, but was instead legally married to a second son, and in that marriage to a famously handsome older man, she was being cucked by her own mother. So, probably with a little help from the Ptolemies, the 18 or 19-year-old Libyan princess orchestrated a palace coup against her mother and husband in 248 BC. They were both killed, which allowed the old Cyrenaean Republic to resume for a few years, with Berenike as the ceremonial head of state while making arrangements to restore her own marriage pact with the future Ptolemy III. Now we move on to the cousins. We are getting far enough removed in time and space that we don't really know what happened with figures like Antiochus II's aunt Laodike, who married Chandragupta Maurya. Presumably, if she had children, they are now part of the Indian nobility somewhere. So all we can really follow is the lineage from Antiochus's uncle, Achaeus. Like their father before them, most of Achaeus's known children were very influential nobles and governors in Anatolia. Achaeus had at least two daughters of note. One, Laodike, was Antiochus II's queen, so we'll save her for later. The other, Antiochus, was married to Attalus, a cousin of Eumenes, the tyrant ruler of Pergamon. Attalus was a pretty run-of-the-mill noble. He and Antiochus were involved in patronizing local temples as well as the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi, and Attalus competed in Olympic chariot racing at least once. However, it's their son we need to focus on. This Pergamene cousin of the Seleucid king, also named Attalus, was legally adopted by the childless Eumenes to become heir of Pergamon, and this Attalus will eventually lend his name to the Attalid dynasty of kings. Achaeus had sons as well, Alexander, Andromachus, and I have hypothesized in the past about another Achaeus. Alexander and Andromachus were just continuing the busy work of managing vast estates and urbanization projects all over Anatolia. They signed land deeds and managed tax policy at various Seleucid outposts around the region, especially when it came to granting land payments to veterans of the Seleucids' many wars. Eventually, it seems that Alexander was promoted all the way up to satrap of Lydia, a position likely occupied by Achaeus in the previous generation. The last cousin on this tier is another, younger, Laodike, daughter of Achaeus, which is partly why I suspect there was a second Achaeus in the family tree. But before talking about Laodike II, we are going to take a break and come back with Laodike I. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. We are back, and let's climb a little bit further down the family tree to Laodike the First, eldest daughter of the original Achaeus, who was betrothed early on to Antiochus the Second. She was already his wife when he took power in 261, and remained fully at that status until the end of the Second Syrian War. This is where I ended episode 151. Up to that point, Laodike had been queen, but not particularly involved in imperial politics. That changed when she was formally pushed to the side, if not legally divorced, in order to disinherit her two sons with the king and make room for the new Ptolemaic princess Berenike. At that point, Laodike was given immense economic power in her own right, with huge tracts of land in her name all over Anatolia, and as much power over those lands and their inhabitants as she could have without just becoming an independent queen. Despite all of the commotion and compensation at the start of this new arrangement, Antiochus Theos still loved, or at least liked, Laodike more than Berenike. If nothing else, she was the mother of all of his children up to that point. So Antiochus kept spending more and more time with Laodike than his new official bride. Laodike and Antiochus had at least 5 children together before the legal separation. We've met one of the daughters before, yet another, Stratonike, probably the eldest or second eldest of the trio. She was married off to King Ariarathes III in Cappadocia to establish a Seleucid ally among the petty kingdoms of the east. Their son, another Ariarathes, was probably born in the mid-240s. But we frankly only know about Hellenistic Cappadocia when it interacts with other kingdoms, so we're in a blank space there at the moment. The second daughter of Laodike and Antiochus was another Apama, and frankly, it's a miracle that we even know she existed in the first place. Apama, the daughter of the king, just happens to be a phrase that survived in Babylonian astronomical diaries dated to Antiochus II's reign. There are some early 20th century historians, namely William Woodthorpe Tarne, who suggest that Antiochus may have arranged for one of his daughters to marry Satrap Diodotus in Bactria as a substitute for installing a Seleucid prince in that position. If that were true, Apameh would be the prime candidate. We know she was at least as far east as Babylon at some point, and nothing else about her, so she's the obvious pick. But that idea is also rooted in the incorrect belief that the Achaemenids always installed their crown princes in Bactria. So, who knows? Laodike's third and youngest daughter was, of course, another Laodike. What else would you name a princess? You've only got, like, four options. In the mid-240s, Laodike had just reached the right age to start considering marriage. And it seems likely that her parents were already engaged in negotiations and hearing proposals from some of the more pro-Seleucid kings in the region. By 246 BC, nothing was firmly established, but based on the amount of time it took to arrange international treaties and wedding ceremonies, they were probably already in discussions with King Mithridates II in Pontus. More on him in a future episode. That just leaves the brothers, Seleucus and another Antiochus. We actually don't know much about these two during their father's reign. They seem to have been pretty close together in age, probably both born in the late 260s, with Seleucus right around 20 years old in 246, and Antiochus somewhere in his late teens. They were both remembered with epithets by later historians. Seleucus would eventually become Seleucus Callinicus, the beautifully triumphant. But early on, and more often by his opponents, he was Seleucid Pagon, meaning the bearded. If you look at his contemporary portraits, the title is a little funny to me. Seleucus the Bearded is occasionally depicted with the barest hint of a goatee. But it was also the most facial hair a Greek king had worn since Alexander the Great's generation popularized shaving. Antiochus was eventually named Hierax, the Hawk, for reasons that are not well recorded, but presumably have something to do with his appearance or hunting. Regardless, neither brother was officially in the running for king after their parents' separation in 253, but that didn't exclude them from marriage politics. Hierax was notably married to a Cappadocian princess to solidify his father's alliance with Ariarathes, while Seleucus was married to yet another Laodike, apparently the daughter of Anacaeus or sister of an Andromachus. Though whether or not she was actually the existing queen's much younger sister is not at all clear. Unfortunately, much like her husband, we effectively know nothing about Laodike II at this point in the story. So now we switch over to Berenike, the new queen from Ptolemaic Egypt, after the Second Syrian War. She was known to historians as Berenike Phernophoros, the dowry bringer, for the massive haul of treasure she brought as a wedding dowry, which effectively served as a war indemnity in disguise. Berenike knew what she was getting into, at least to some degree. She knew this marriage had been forced on Antiochus, and according to one story, she was so apprehensive about leaving home that her father routinely sent bottled water from the Nile so that she would never have to drink from an unfamiliar source. As I've said before, Antiochus II and Berenike were not together very often, in the carnal or social senses of the phrase. This was despite Ptolemy's repeated insistence that they have a son and actually complete Antiochus's end of the treaty obligation. Of course, we don't actually know whether or not Antiochus and Berenike were trying to make that happen over the course of the early 240s, but the general impression seems to be that they were not. This is until Ptolemy Philadelphus's health started declining in 247. Philadelphus was in his early 60s and had been king for most of his life when he started to decline. That seemed to be enough pressure for Antiochus to perform his marital duties. When Philadelphus died, it would nullify all of their existing treaties. And if Antiochus didn't have a half-Ptolemaic heir to show the incoming Ptolemy III, it might just cause another Syrian war. To avoid that specific outcome, he started spending more time with Berenike. You know, nothing sets the mood quite like finding out that her dad is in terminal decline. Morbid circumstances aside, they seem to have conceived not long before Philadelphus passed in January of 246, and Ptolemy III Euergetes came to power. Of course, there were no pregnancy tests at the time, and word traveled slowly. So Euergetes also complained that his sister still hadn't had a son, but they all would have found out the good news within a month or two. Well, it was good news for Antiochus Theos, Euergetes, and Berenike. Laodike and her sons were none too pleased to find out they were officially being sidelined just as the king's first two sons reached adulthood. But they held their tongues and stayed their hands for a few months. After all, Berenike could have a daughter, which would buy Laodike's household some time, before Berenike could try again. Or she'd have a miscarriage, or she'd have a healthy baby boy who then got, I don't know, typhus. They were not that lucky. Sometime around late spring or early summer of 246, Berenike gave birth to a healthy baby boy named Antiochus, even as the king went back to Anatolia to live with Laodike and his adult sons. We don't know what exactly conspired behind the scenes. Ancient historians were quick to blame Queen Laodike I as nefarious and powerful woman, much in the tradition of the Achaemenid queens. Although, I don't know how much sense that actually makes. Antiochus clearly favored her, and this new baby was just that, a baby. Anything can happen to a baby. If we're blaming queens, Berenike seems much more plausible. And even that doesn't seem like the most likely option to me at this point in time. Because again, anything can happen to a baby. Whether it was one of his wives, agents of another king, or just natural bad luck, King Antiochus fell crushingly ill in early July of that year. Many historians blamed poison, but it was the 3rd century BCE. It could have been an infected toenail for all it matters. Regardless of the exact cause, the king died. He was Antiochus II Theos, Antiochus the god. He was around 40 years old and had been king, the Basileus, for 15 years. He died at Laodike's estate in Anatolia, which gave his first wife the advantage of, but you can hardly keep the king's death secret for too long. So soon, Berenike found out in Antioch, and she had the advantage of having her friends and allies already inside the walls of a capital very close to the border with her brother's kingdom. And then, the empire exploded. But I'm going to delay that story for 2 episodes. The whole Hellenistic world is about to be on fire. So next time, we need to check in with the Seleucids' powerful neighbors and establish their political situations before launching into a war on all fronts. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.